Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the Russia Challenge. With me to discuss U.S. policy toward Russia is Fiona Hill. Fiona is the Robert Bosch Senior Fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. From 2017 to 2019, she served as Deputy Assistant to the President and Senior Director for European and Russian Affairs on the staff of the National Security Council. Her new book, There Is Nothing For You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century, is out now. Fiona, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Jim. It's great to be with you.
I want to get to the whole issue of U.S. policy toward Russia, but if we may, I'd like to actually start with your book, which is in large part a memoir about how you got from a small, rather blighted town in northern England to the White House. So perhaps you could take us on that tour, that journey from where you started to where you ended up.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. And I decided to use that biographical story as kind of like the through line to the book, and obviously to tell a larger story that touches on foreign policy, public policy, and, you know, some of the larger historical trends of the 20th century in particular, but, you know, leading up to where we are today and the political crisis, frankly, that the United States finds itself in. And the reason I did that is because of my own experience with massive dislocation, socioeconomic dislocation, back in my hometown of Bishop Auckland, because I was growing up with the whole period where the old industries of the region, which were all heavy nationalized industries, they were all nationalized by the British government after World War II as part of the reconstruction effort, were either being closed down or privatized under the Thatcher government, which came in 1979. And so my whole childhood, my teens and my early 20s when I went off to college, university, was shaped by this period of deindustrialization and hundreds of thousands of people losing their jobs all at once. And that gave me a certain perspective, I guess, on world affairs when I stepped back and kind of, you know, realized what was kind of happening, not just to me and to my family, but, you know, to the larger region and how you put that in context. My father, in 1984, when I was leaving high school, had basically said to me, if I was going to go off and get an education, go to university and college, get some qualifications, that there was nothing for me here. You know, there's nothing for you here, he said to me, which became, you know, the title of the book, that I wasn't going to be able to find a good job in my hometown. He himself had, you know, lost multiple jobs in the coal fields, then the steelworks, the brickworks, and he'd eventually ended up working in the local hospital as a porter on the kind of lowest rung of the socioeconomic ladder. So my family were really strapped for money and, you know, in quite dire straits at times. And he was basically saying, look, I wish I'd had an education. I wish I'd had qualifications apart from on the job, all the things that I could have done with it. You need to go out and do that. But to do that, you're going to have to go somewhere else. And so my whole journey out of Bishop Auckland is shaped by these larger socioeconomic developments, this sort of dislocation as a result of the shift from heavy industry to the new service sector, modernization and innovation of British industry, the privatization, mass privatization of Margaret Thatcher and her efforts under her policies to transform the whole country. And then by larger international affairs, because I decided to study Russian, and this is where it fits into the foreign policy themes of the podcast and how this comes out into the book, against the backdrop of the Euro missile crisis in the period from 1977, when I was about 11 or 12, to 1987, with the signing of the INF Treaty, when I'm actually become a student in Moscow. And that 10-year period, again, a very formative point of my life, was one war scare after another. The kind of feeling that the United States and the Soviet Union were going to come to blows, that end up being a nuclear exchange between them, especially, you know, given the stationing of SS-20 and Pershing missiles on various sides of, you know, the Iron Curtain in Europe, the UK and other parts of Europe would be ground zero for nuclear Armageddon. You know, the whole popular culture, all of the politics was infused by this fear of a nuclear conflagration. It was a campaign for nuclear disarmament. You know, people like myself as, you know, teens and, you know, kids in their early 20s sort of felt this sense of hopelessness, impending doom. And that's the backdrop where I decided to study Russian. And it's that decision to study Russian, taken in 1983-1984 at the peak of this kind of Cold War scares, that propels me forward from Bishop Auckland, all through a coincidence of incredible timing, coming to Harvard in 1989 for graduate school as the Berlin Wall comes down.
Well, let's sort of slow it up here, Fiona, if we can, and sort of take us on that journey, specifically how you got from Bishop Auckland to Harvard. There were a couple of stops in between.
Yes, because in 1984, I decide I'm going to study Russian. And it's really kind of at the behest or even inspiration of a couple of members of my extended family, including an older cousin of my father's, who I called Uncle Charlie, who during World War II had been in the Merchant Marine from the United Kingdom taking supplies during the peak of the war to the Soviet Union, to Murmansk and Arkhangelsk, as part of the Arctic convoys. And he couldn't get over the fact that we'd been wartime allies with the Soviet Union, and then suddenly we were literally at loggerheads and that we were about to blow each other up. And he basically said to me one day with my dad when we'd run into him in our town, you know, Fiona, you're good at languages, you want to go study Russian and figure it out. And I thought, yeah, I should. Why not? And, it's that naivety of, the kid who's in their late teens. And I thought, well, I could become a translator. I could, kind of maybe help with some arms control negotiations or something, because, we're starting to kind of get that feeling that something needed to be done. Another cousin of my mum's was in a campaign for nuclear disarmament. She was a Greenham Common woman. This is the Women's Peace Camp that's set up outside of an Air Force base in the south of England, Greenham Common, where they were basically stationing, nuclear equipped aircraft, for example, for tactical, nukes. And, the whole, as I said, the whole atmosphere was suffused with this idea of impending nuclear doom. And I thought, well, instead of just sitting worrying about it, panicking, having nightmares, I should try to do something. And so 1984, what an amazing time to decide to study Russian. It was also Orwell's 1984, Big Brother's Watching You. And it's just before Mikhail Gorbachev comes into power in the Soviet Union. And I go to St. Andrews University, where I get basically a place to study Russian from scratch against the backdrop of the UK miners' strike. And the miners' strike, miners from the Soviet Union, from the Donbass, which of course now is a huge coal area in Ukraine, which is being contested with the Russians, they have a whip around their unions, which of course are pretty much controlled by the government, but they basically raise money for the miners of the UK. And I actually get some of that money as part of, kind of my stipend to study Russian, to help me with some of the basic Russian language courses. So this is kind of amazing. The miners of the Donbass helped me, kind of go and study my basic Russian language course. And Donbass is still, at that point, part of the Soviet Union. And it kind of, things like that just keep on happening. It's the timing. I get a scholarship to go to study in the Soviet Union as part of the British Council's Russian Language Undergraduate Study Committee in 1987, just as Gorbachev and Reagan are in the midst of all their symmetry and they sign the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, putting paid to all of these nightmares about an inevitable exchange of intermediate nuclear missiles, SS-20 and Pershing missiles, after this whole 10 years of, my life being shaped by this. And that's just an amazing thing. And I'm in the Soviet Union just in time to see the peak of perestroika, glasnost, Gorbachev and Reagan meeting in Moscow for the Moscow summit in the summer of 1988. I get a job there as a stringer for NBC News. I get to meet all these Americans. I see people like George Shultz, kind of doing interviews. I see Gorbachev and Reagan walking around on Red Square, Reagan giving his famous speech at Moscow State University, and I'm just hooked. And I find out from an American professor, again by chance, about all these scholarships to Harvard and to other universities in the United States. And so I decide to apply. And then, miraculously, I get a scholarship to Harvard in 1989, arriving just in time for the Berlin Wall to come down and for the, whole opening up of the period that leads not just to the dissolution of the Soviet bloc, but to the eventual dissolution of the Soviet Union itself. And I'm studying Soviet studies at Harvard.
Pretty good place to do that.
Pretty good place. What's now the Davis Center for Russian Studies, but at the time was the Russian Research Center. And I get this degree, a master's degree in Soviet studies. And within months, it's obsolete because the Soviet Union has gone on me. It's just disappeared off to the ash heap of history.
So you go to Harvard, you get your PhD, but you make the decision to stay in the United States. Why?
Well, a number of factors. Again, a bit of that long arm of Lady Chance in very strange ways. So I finished this master's degree in Soviet studies, and this is just before the Soviet Union has come apart in that summer. I'm thinking, again, on that track of, well, I could become an interpreter, or maybe I could come, some sort of junior diplomat involved in negotiations, with the Russians. And I apply for a particular entrance cohort into the British Foreign Service, into their research and analytical division, equivalent of intelligence and research, INR, in the US State Department, because I'm still a very much a British citizen, and I'm thinking that I'm going to go back to the UK immediately after the master's degree. And this was a kind of a highly selective entry. It wasn't like the mass entry into the Foreign Service, and it only came up every couple of years, and there was only a very small number of places. And I applied, and there was also a chance that I might have gone from there to the GCHQ in Cheltenham, which is the place that you sort of sit around listening to at that time, Soviet fighter pilots pilots trying to figure out, you know, what are they up to? Because my Russian at this point was really very good. I'd spent a year in Moscow. I'd been trained at a translators institute. I was kind of, you know, thinking to myself, this was the path. The master's was supposed to be the next step. And to cut to the chase, they lose my application materials. And they lose it in the most ridiculous way possible. I'm right through to the final selection and my file falls behind a radiator in the Foreign Office along with someone else's. And I don't hear anything. And I'm pretty convinced that I've got a good shot at this. I thought at least I'd get, you know, one of the interviews and hear nothing. Because I've already gone, you know, right to the point where I've sent in my birth certificate. You know, this is the old days, Jim. You and I yep. remember it. It's not like, you know, you can replace this stuff very easily. And I've sent it registered and, you know, I didn't have a phone or anything and I didn't photocopy it, anything. It's been a real effort to get all this material together. It's the final, you know, selection for the top five people they're going to interview and I hear nothing. And eventually I'm really worried about this and I get to a payphone and I'm putting in quarters, the old days of payphones, trying to call the Foreign Office to find out why I haven't heard anything because I should have heard by a bond. They said, we didn't get your application materials. And I said, but
ouch.
I've got the slip for registered mail that says you received them on this particular date. And, you know, kind of there's a signature and all the rest of it, you know, because you get the slip back in the mail. And they said they'd look into it. And of course, then they find it covered in water stains and dirt and dust bunnies, you know, from the back of the radiator and a bit of an old plant or something, along with somebody else's file. And indeed, you know, it was received, but I wasn't in the final pool and they'd already gone on and offered people positions and they can't reopen it. So they said, sorry, you'll just have to apply next time. And I'm thinking, next time? When's next time? I said, well, maybe 2 or 3 years from now, because, you know, we've got the pool for now. And I'm thinking, disaster. What am I going to do next? And that's how I end up staying in the United States, because one of my professors, Timothy Colton, who many people know, he hears about this tragedy. And I run into him as I'm walking through Harvard Yard. And he spots me and he says, hey, Fiona, I've just heard about a job down at the Kennedy School with Graham Allison. They're looking for some interpreters to help them work on this project they're doing, the Grand Bargain, you know, basically trying to figure out how the US can help the Soviet Union then and Gorbachev basically transform their economy. This, of course, you know, becomes very momentous and, you know, fortuitous timing. And he said they need some people to help translate some documents and things that they're doing. And I recommended you. And I mean, it's not like you've got a job to go on to. Thank you very much, Professor Colton. He said, you know, maybe this would be helpful. And boy, was it helpful, because I end up then getting a full-time job with Graham Allison and his team at the Kennedy School. It's on-campus work. I can extend my visa after I've graduated. And that then puts me on the path for staying in the United States, because in somewhere like the Kennedy School of Government, I get introduced to all these different networks of people. I start working on these technical assistance projects. And then I decide to stay on to do my PhD, because I immediately hit a glass ceiling. It's very obvious that, you know, kind of, I mean, like everybody, you know, kind of in the junior, you know, kind of years, you realize you've got to move on there with the qualifications.
You need more credentials to...
Exactly. You should realize that the credentials are not enough, because I'm going now in a slightly different direction. And, you know, I've given up on, you know, being an interpreter for the British government or the UN or something at this point, but I've used all of my interpretation and translation skills. But now I realize I need to credential myself further before my now obsolete degree in Soviet studies. And so I decided to do a PhD in history and keep at Harvard, because I can just, you know, stay within that context. My visa can be extended and one thing leads to another. And I start, you know, dating an American.
Okay. So that also comes
into it. That as well.
So we first have the fruitful era in which somebody mislays a file, changes the direction of your life. We also have the love interest. You get your PhD, you eventually end up at the Brookings Institution as a senior fellow.
Where I meet you.
Where we meet you. We were colleagues back in the day.
That's right.
And you become an American citizen. You do a couple stints in the U.S. government, working for the National Intelligence Council, as I recall.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. You're at Brookings, and in late 2016, early 2017, you decide to join the staff of the National Security Council for the Trump administration. Again, as a former senior fellow at Brookings, I will note that descriptions of Brookings often come with the description, the left-leaning Brookings Institution. So how does someone from the Brookings Institution end up on the staff of the Trump administration?
Well, look, putting you know, the circumstance of it aside, I think we also know that Brookings, you know, like the council and, you know, CSIS, Carnegie, you know, is much more centrist. And, you know, when you and I were there, you know, initially, of course, Richard Haass, now your boss at the council, but was our boss too, and, you know, was very much steeped in Republican Party politics, and indeed goes on, you know, to work for George W. Bush and his administration. Our initial president was Mike Armacost, again, another, you know, Republican former ambassador, you know, in the State Department. And, you know, it's just the kind of the feature of the way that people talk about think tanks is there's always some sort of assumption, you know, there of some partisan bias. And, you know, both of us are very very well aware that there were people of many different, you know, political persuasions there. But I am completely unaffiliated. I've never had a party allegiance in the UK or, you know, even certainly not in the United States. And it's really on the basis of my professional background and this kind of long tail of work on Russia that this comes about. It was very unexpected to me, but from my previous stints in the government, in the National Intelligence Council, I was the National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia, you know, kind of being the chief analyst for all of the intel reporting and doing a lot of briefings. I worked from the last couple of years of George W. Bush to the first year of the Obama administration. And in that period, I worked with a number of people who end up, one of them on the campaign for Trump, which is a bit of a surprise, but others who are then getting detailed in or even brought in through the Republican Party apparatus. And one of the people that I met in the National Intelligence Council was General Michael Flynn, who at the time, 2006 to 2009, when I'm there, was the intel guy for the chairman's office for the Joint Chiefs. And he's my counterpart. And we work together very closely on Russia and, you know, related issues. Although that's not really his background, that's kind of what we end up working on in that time frame when Admiral Mullen was the chairman. And so fast forward, this is, you know, extraordinarily strange, you know, to me, because I'd kind of lost contact with what he'd been doing. He'd gone off to then head the Defense Intelligence Agency. And after that, I'd sort of lost the thread. He pops up on the campaign, I have to say, in somewhat rather unexpected fashion. And I was doing a bit of a double take. Is this the General Flynn that I know from, you know, my Nick days, the same guy, you know, because he came across as extraordinarily political, obviously, in that context, not at all, you know, as I recalled him. And then the other person was Katie McFarland, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, who I'd met on many occasions at the Council and who had worked in previous administrations, going, she'd worked in the Reagan administration, you know, for example, in the White House, and had a program on Fox News on defense and security issues. And it invited me on several times to talk about Putin and Russia and the work that I'd done. And basically, Katie approaches me for some, you know, larger context about Russia and what was kind of going on. And the next thing, I'm asked by both Katie and General Flynn if I would be willing to take on the position. I had hoped that I would just be able to offer my, you know, perspective, you know, as we like to do from think tanks, you know, kind of basically, here's what I would tell you, you know, here's the context, thank you very much, you know, kind of, and then, you know, we go back to, you know, what we're usually doing and kind of writing about things. But no, they actually asked me if I would come into the administration. And the whole intent had been to try to figure out what to do about this interference in 2016, and also to try to sit down with Trump and explain to him just what Putin and the intel services and everything else were up to. Well, let's just say it didn't quite work out like that. But that was the idea of coming in. And there were a whole host of people I'd worked with at DNI, many other people I'd worked with and knew from Pentagon, you know, times, you know, going back to that Bush-Obama transition, and others that I knew from the Republican Party circles, either on Capitol Hill, you know, from the Bush administration when I'd been the NIO then too. And so there was actually a large group of people who I'd previously worked with, and others, you know, who were detailed in from across the government, from the Russia, another community that I knew really well, you know, from my long years of working, people I'd known from grad school, honestly, as well as, you know, other jobs at the Kennedy School. And I thought, well, look, there's a team of people in here I know, we might be able to do something to mitigate this disaster of Russian interference in 2016.
I think you make an important point, Fiona, that is lost on many people, or maybe not understood, which is, as you go from administration to administration, a lot of the people who staff a president, particularly in the area of national security, foreign policy, are people who aren't political. They are, as you describe yourself, sort of nonpartisan experts. They work for the government because they're hoping to bring their best analysis to inform American foreign policy, rather than being an advocate for the candidate. So I'm glad you made that point. Obviously, for you, you work in the Trump administration. Your book details what your experiences are working for Trump. I do want to move on to the question of what U.S. policy toward Russia should be. But I would probably be remiss if I didn't ask you, A, what was it like working for Donald Trump? And B, what are your reflections after having testified in his first impeachment hearings?
Yeah, well, I lay quite a lot of this out in the book, because I have to say that I became greatly disturbed and very worried about the state of our domestic politics as a result of working within the White House in this tumultuous period. And I remain so, and, you know, that was one of the reasons for writing the book and, you know, trying to lay a lot of things out about how we got from A to B and how I got from A to B as well.
In my own personal life. Subtitle of your book is Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century. And you're certainly, given your personal biography, someone who had opportunities, was able to make something of them.
Yes, and I'm part of the book, which, you know, we're not going to talk about quite so much in this podcast because it's on foreign policy, is to show how the crisis of opportunity, particularly in the United States, but also in the UK, has led us to the populist politics that we see now. And what I mean by that is this constraints on social mobility, so that people feel that they're left out of a system that is basically giving all of its benefits to a very tiny group or an increasingly tiny group. It's not just about income inequality, but it's about the idea that used to be ingrained in America, and certainly when I came here in 1989, that anybody would have a chance to do what whatever they wanted to, you know, within reason. I mean, there's always going to be poor people. Not everyone's going to be rich, but then everyone would have a chance for mobility, geographic mobility, social mobility, economic ability. You know, when I came in 1989, there was expectation that people would do better than their parents. And that had been kind of basically ingrained, that idea of the American dream is all about opportunity. And today, the United States has the lowest social mobility of any advanced country. UK is not too far behind, but the United States is shocking about how difficult it is for people to get ahead.
But that's not how we see ourselves. We
no,
see ourselves
and as the that's land of part of the political frustration. So you've only got a 7% chance to do what I did, which is go from, or even less, because I've gone from a much lower part of the quintile to the much higher point of the top of the quintile. You know, but 7% to go from the bottom 20% to the top 20%, and probably a kind of a one in a million snowball hell's you know, chance to do what I did. And I do know other people have done it in the US context, but all my kind of age, and it's much more unlikely for somebody who was born in the 80s and moving on in the 90s. And I also get an education in which is completely paid for by scholarships, grants, or my local government in the UK. I have no educational debt. I mean, how many kids these days, I mean, you with, you know, older kids, I mean, who's going to leave without any educational debt these days, unless their parents can pay for them, which means that the meritocracy, you know, keeps getting, you know, more and more concentrated in, you know, kind of a tiny cohort of people who can afford to, you know, kind of pay for their kids, so their kids can always, you know, keep on getting ahead.
And education's far more expensive than it was.
It certainly wasn't in the late 80s. Exactly. I mean, you and I are the same generation, and, you know, there was a lot more opportunities for people in our cohort. And that really kind of feeds into what I start to see in the Trump administration. You know, Trump is not thinking about national security in the kind of ways that we would hope he would. I was very disappointed about that. He's playing domestic politics all the time. He's sort of privatizing foreign policy, you know, for those purposes. Although I would actually argue there's a lot of continuity between his foreign policy in previous administrations, and that the Biden administration, we can talk about, is also picking up on many of the things that he did. But in the domestic arena, he's playing to the base of grievances for people who feel that they've been cut out, left out by, you know, elitist, depending on how you describe it, unelected bureaucrats, or, you know, the super rich, super wealthy, super educated, who are just leaving everybody else behind. And he's playing to that big cleavage in education where, you know, he's playing to the non-college educated populace who just
We're both on the other side of that cleavage. We're
exactly.
Both highly educated. Went to elite.
I used to be well and truly on the side that they're on. I mean, my father went down the pits at the mines at 14, had no qualifications whatsoever, no exams from school to speak to, only trained on the job. And my mum went on to be a nurse, but I mean, all of her qualifications were also, you know, job training. They weren't in any, you know, kind of elite institutions. I'm the first in my immediate family to go to college. And so, you know, kind of, but that used to be the general aspiration. But, you know, Trump's playing, like many other people, on this kind of cleavage now, and that, you know, kind of the American dream has disappeared for those without any kind of, you know, further education. And that's, you know, kind of what I kept seeing inside of the institution. It's kind of playing to division, playing in the National Security Council, the way that the domestic politics fed into everything. And I thought that I could cut through all of the noise of domestic politics and be able to focus on national security, and I discovered that I couldn't. And that's how we end up, all of us, nobody could, in the first impeachment. And I come away from that deeply disturbed about the state of American politics, as I think I made quite clear during my testimony, that this effort to not just run domestic political errands by people who are loyal to the president and, you know, trying to pervert Ukraine policy, for example, but also just this whole privatization of the national security and foreign policy sphere with all kinds of people leaping in.
What do you mean by that, the privatization of foreign policy?
I mean by all kinds of people who are sort of strap hangers, hangers on, you know, to the president, sort of leaping in there. You have lobbyists, you have advocates, you know, for people who've taken on, you know, foreign entities and foreign governments as clients, you know, kind of lobbying and, you know, getting in through an open door for personal interest. People have business interests, but they've got to know the president or a member of his family, and they're just kind of leaping in there. This is why Masha Yovanovitch, our ambassador to Ukraine, was sacked, was removed, because a couple of Ukrainian Americans who are working with Rudy Giuliani and have their own business deals decide she's in the way, along with a group of, you know, corrupt Ukrainian officials, and they decide to denounce her to Trump. And it's captured on a video that they themselves take during a dinner in Trump International Hotel in April of 2018. And we only discover this during the course of all of these investigations into, you know, the whole circumstances surrounding this phone call between President Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine, where he asks President Zelensky to help him, you know, basically defame his opponent in, you know, what will be the 2020 presidential election, Joe Biden. But we only find out in the course of all of this that these guys are the people who were responsible initially for the sequence of events that leads to the removal of our ambassador to Ukraine, Maria Yovanovitch, because they tell Trump that she's bad-mouthing them. Complete lies. And he says, get rid of her. I want her, you know, removed, because he's so sensitive to criticism that he, you know, he can't take the idea that somebody might be bad-mouthing him. And he believes them immediately because they're from his peer circles. And they're, you know, kind of, he knows they work with Rudy Giuliani and send their donors, you know, kind of, as it turns out, illegally to campaigns because they're now, you know, they've got indicted and there's court cases going on against them. But it's that private enterprise, you know, that's kind of leaping into foreign policy and sets off a whole chain of events.
Okay. In your book, There Is Nothing For You Here, you detail this and go in a lot more detail in terms of your experience in the Trump administration. But what I want to do now, Fiona, is sort of look forward and sort of look at U.S. policy toward Russia as it is and perhaps how it should be. You made a reference a moment ago, which I think is correct, that there's a fair amount of continuity between the Trump administration and the Biden administration when it comes to Russia. I would note that you were in the White House when the Trump administration released its national security strategy in December of 2017, which tried to reframe the nature of American foreign policy as one of being about great power competition, about China and about Russia. My sense is that framing has stuck. It seems that, as you can you mentioned, the Biden administration has embraced that wholesale. But I was struck when I was reading your recent foreign affairs article, which is drawn from the book, that you wrote, let me quote you here, even though foreign policy circles in Washington and Moscow still view U.S.-Russian relations through the lens of great power competition, the struggle for Europe is over. For the United States, China, not Russia, poses the greatest foreign policy challenge of the 21st century. So that leads me to ask the question whether or not we should think of Russia in terms of great power competition, or should we sort of recast how we think about our relations with Russia?
I think we have to be very careful about getting stuck in these frames. I mean, you and I, you know, have worked on foreign policy issues for a very long time, and we know how seductive framing can be, and, you know, how then everything is basically shaped in policy terms or even people's whole outlook on issues. And often as a result, they miss other things that are going on here. Now, the Russians would love us to have that frame. And I think, you know, just recently, you know, one senior official, maybe it was General Milley, I'm not really sure here, so I apologize if it wasn't General Milley, talked about a tripartite world, a tripolar world with Russia, the United States and China. And of course, you know, the Russians are delighted because they do still think about the world in geopolitical terms.
And they want to be an equal.
And they want to be an equal. And so the idea of this is very seductive for them too. And they're always kind of feeding into this. Because certainly when I would try to suggest to Russians that the world has actually changed, I mean, they love the national security strategy framing, actually. They would say, no, it isn't. We're still our geopolitical foes. And I would say, look, we are not carving Europe up. And there was an episode when I was sent out to deal directly with the Russians in April of 2019, when we were trying to resolve the situation in Venezuela, you know, to basically try to get a coalition of countries together to force Maduro to recognize the Guaido interim government and to, you know, try to put Venezuela on a different track there after Maduro basically effects a self-coup to keep himself in power there. And we were constantly getting, you know, kind of thwarted by various different issues. It wasn't the most strategic approach that could have been done. I have a lot of complaints about that as well. But we managed to frame it in such a way that the Russians immediately saw an opportunity for doing, you know, one of these great geopolitical exchanges. I mean, people may recall that the Russians very quickly moved to take advantage of the Venezuela situation to send in a whole bunch of GRU military intelligence guys on a plane to help Maduro stay in place because they became convinced the United States was going to invade, you know, via Colombia. You know, kind of they're playing out in their minds the old Cold War scenarios. This is, you know, Panama, Haiti, or this is, you know, kind of all of these other, you know, games that the CIA and, you know, the United States like to play in Latin and South America. Is our chance to get back in the game again? And so they're kind of a bunch of guys on a plane, they kind of get out there. And then they're kind of suggesting to us behind the scenes, how about we do a swap for Venezuela and Ukraine? Because, you know, they believe that what's happening in Ukraine is a proxy war with the United States. This is the old style Cold War. We're trying to divide up Europe still. We're not, you know, we're trying to find a solution to bolster Ukraine's sovereignty and independence. Of course, Ukraine's become this nasty little item in our domestic politics as well because of all these machinations on, you know, the kind of Russia 2016 intervention that's just become so complex, no one can make any sense of it. But the Russians sort of smell an opportunity. This is illustrative of, you know, the kind of the risks here. And so I am sent out to kind of disavow them of the fact that we're going to make any kind of swap between Ukraine and Venezuela. And they're basically saying, you know, you're talking about the Monroe Doctrine. We say we're not. You know, we're talking about, you know, what used to be, you know, the Yeltsin Doctrine about, you know, kind of the near abroad and the new Putin Doctrine. You know, you keep out of our territory and we'll keep out of yours. And they basically want to sit down at the table and hash out, you know, kind of where the dividing lines between our interests
draw lines on the map.
And draw lines on the map, yeah. And they think that a Venezuela-Ukraine swap would help with this. And we're just like, no, this is not happening. Venezuela has been dealt with on its own terms and Ukraine has to be dealt with in its own terms. And that's part of that great power competition framing, that the Russians, you know, kind of see this is great. That means that we're still into this dividing lines in Europe. It gets to the bottom of, you know, know, NATO expansion. They see Ukraine as a proving ground, a fighting ground, Belarus the same, Georgia, all of, you know, the territory, the Baltics included, Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, Czech Republic. These are all still up for grabs. We're still trying to kind of work things out in Eastern Europe. And of course, the United States, for most of the, apart from those who are still fixated on Russia and Russia policy, have moved on. They're worrying about the rise of China, everything going on in the Asia Pacific. And Russia's having a harder time proving to us that they have a major role in the Asia Pacific. And, you know, at one point, President Trump was a bit incredulous when Putin reminded him that Russia has a border with North Korea. I mean, admittedly, it's a very small sliver of a border with North Korea, but, you know, President Trump was certainly not thinking of Russia as a major player in the Asia Pacific. And so, you know, the Russians have also then, you know, tried to flex muscles, make it very clear that, you know, the recent talk about firing on a US ship, you know, somewhere near the Sea of Ochotsk, you know, to kind of remind us that they're there too, because they're trying to play into this, you know, depiction of the world as a tripolar, you know, great power competition. When really, you know, many of the risks that we have from Russia at the moment is for them still trying to grab our attention to stay in the game and using more insidious forms of influence. What they did in 2016 of trying to interfere in our election system, hacking and releasing of emails, you know, getting into the Facebook and other platforms, dirty money, ransomware, you know, all kinds of financial crimes, influence, you know, political parties, you know, the kinds of stuff that they also used to do during the Cold War. But what really is, you know, taking advantage of political vulnerabilities, political infighting and divisions and corruption in Western societies, because the main goal is to kind of show that the West is no better than Russia, because Putin is very much focused on keeping himself in power. This is not, you know, purely about geopolitics, but regime survival. And Putin, as the sort of like the champion of Russia, the great savior against a malign West that's always trying to kind of bring Russia to its knees, the old Cold War image of Russia as a superpower, his whole image and his presidency is tied up in that. And he feels very vulnerable domestically. And so as he pushes up that bigger picture, that framework of a great power competition has become very useful for him for domestic mobilization.
So what then should our framing be, Fiona? How should we think about Russia policy in that context? And I ask especially because Russia seems recently to have moved closer to China. Moscow and Beijing have deepened their relations. And many people would argue that it's never a good strategy to pursue policies that lead your main potential adversaries to close ranks.
Well, I certainly agree with that. I mean, irrespective of the framing of, you know, great power competition, you know, it's clearly not in our interest to have, you know, Russia and China working in lockstep, you know, to basically kind of thwart, you know, American interests at all turns. And, you know, also, if Russia is opening up the door for more Chinese actions, you know, following in, you know, Russia's footsteps, we've already had the massive exfiltration of data by the Chinese. We've had intellectual property theft. And, you know, we clearly are in a systemic competition with China on the economic and security front, you know, on all terms here. And I would actually also argue that we need to be very careful about that as well. We do not want to have that framing either, because look, the bigger picture is the world has changed. We kept trying to bring this up with the Russians. You know, we have a couple of massive existential threats, and the Russians are feeling that now. Climate change, and you know, we've still got COP26 going on in Glasgow, the second part of that, no longer the leaders, but you know, people trying to actually thrash out what are we going to do about an existential threat that affects every single one of us. I mean, who cares we're in a great power competition, you know, when the world is burning, honestly? I mean, if we really started thinking about this in a sensible kind of way. I mean, Russia's fires on the tundra and their forests and their peat, you know, bogs have been larger in size than all of the fires in the American West taken together. Their methane emissions from natural causes, from the melting of the permafrost, which acted as kind of a capstone for keeping that in, are enormous. The United States and Russia are the biggest emitters of methane, which was a big focus at Glasgow in the world. We could work together on this, actually, because it's going to be very challenging to reduce those emissions. It's not just flaring from associated gas in oil fields, but these emissions, these natural gas emissions out again in the melting permafrost and in the seas where the sea ice used to keep it in too, in the Arctic region. I mean, we've got a lot of trouble here on our hands. And then the pandemic. Russia's, you know, got so used to using anti-vax propaganda, you know, we've got plenty of our own, but, you know, fueling that. They wanted to talk down all the other Western vaccines and talk up Sputnik, their vaccine. And it's really boomeranged in a terrible way for them. They have the highest infectivity rates and highest mortality rates of any time during the pandemic. And one of the reasons why Putin couldn't go to COP26. They've got a mess on their hands. And we ought to be able to work with them on some of these critical issues. We should have been able to get a global vaccine program up and running with the Russians instead of playing vaccine nationalism. We've done that before with smallpox, multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis. We eventually did it with HIV/AIDS after, you know, the Russians had a disaster with it. They blamed us as well on a capitalist country. It was a Western disease. disease turned out, of course, not to be. They had a terrible AIDS crisis, especially with, you know, heroin use and, you know, needle, you know, infections, just like lots of Europe, you know, had too. We've got ways in which we can work with them. So my argument here is we've got to be able to change that paradigm with the Russians to, and Chinese as well. I mean, we've got Former Secretary Kerry, you know, running around everywhere, you know, trying to get the Chinese and Russians on board with climate change. We've got to figure out how busting out of those paradigms to try to find some kind of way forward where we can work with them as well.
But you seem to be running uphill into a stiff wind with that advice, Fiona. As I sort of read the mood here in Washington, D.C., people agree that Russia is the adversary. And whether you're talking about their relations with Belarus, what they're doing with Ukraine, activity in the Middle East, you already mentioned Venezuela, that what the United States has to do is meet that with even more toughness, more sanctions, more coercion, which seems to then sort of feed into what I take to be Putin's sense of imperilment from Western actions.
We are most definitely in one of those terrible vicious circles. There's no doubt about it. Like you say, we are going to be running into headwinds. There's no doubt about it. But we've got to bear in mind, you know, that this is going to be extraordinarily difficult. And, you know, with Vladimir Putin ostensibly remaining in the Kremlin till 2036, this is going to be a long haul, a long game here. I mean, it'll get back to Kennan's, you know, long telegram and, you know, the whole point of how do we constrain, restrain, and basically blunt the impact of Russian actions? Because the point is that they don't want to let this up. You know, as I say in the Foreign Affairs article, for Putin, it's a kind of a domestic imperative for him. You know, he's not just making the world or trying to make the world safe for autocracy and authoritarianism. He's making it for his personal clique. I mean, an awful lot of these authoritarian regimes now, be it in Russia, in China, you know, in Turkey, elsewhere, it's all about personalization of politics and keeping a particular set of people in power and then, you know, shaping and retrofitting the ideology and, you know, the kind of international stance around that as well. And so Putin sees his position as under siege from opposition, you know, to all kinds of other kind of problems going on. He obviously doesn't want to find Russia in any shape or form, in any kind of difficult relationship with China, irrespective of historic and possible future tensions. He wants to lash himself to China, but he has to also show China that he's a worthy partner, not just a sort of second fiddle or, you know, kind of lesser entity. And the Russians know the Chinese are not that, you know, kind of enamored with them as the Russians are enamored of the idea of a strategic partnership with China. And so he's constantly got to be performing, showing that, you know, kind of that they're taking on the United States, you know, for domestic and international audiences. And just, you know, his whole mindset is one shaped by the Cold War, shaped by the adversarial relationship with the United States, as is the Russian intelligence services. What would they have to do if they weren't continuing to play that game against the United States? You know, is Estonia or Georgia or Ukraine, you know, kind of just, you know, kind of where they would focus themselves? It absolutely isn't. I mean, you can see it by the amount of investment they've put in into intelligence operatives in the United States. Their embassies were literally dens of spies. Ours were not. We'd moved on from all of this. So the point is that we have to find ways of blunting it, get rid of their intel operatives, you know, kind of close up our own loopholes, make ourselves less vulnerable to subversion and, you know, their kinds of policies. And that will, over time, force them to change their calculus. It's just going to take time.
I should note, you know a thing or two about Mr. Putin. You wrote a biography of him. I think it was titled Mr. Putin. Is it the Kremlin's operative?
Did I get operative the title in the right? Kremlin, yeah.
Operative in the Kremlin.
Putin, operative in the Kremlin, yes, with our old colleague Clifford Gaddy, yeah, back in the day at Brookings, yeah.
So I highly recommend that book. I mean, there's a lot more we could talk about in terms of U.S.-Russia relations, Fiona, but we're coming to the end of our time. And I guess what I'd like to do is to close by going back to where you started. Do you go back to Bishop Auckland much? What do people in Bishop Auckland think about seeing you appearing on the telly at night?
Well, I'm about to find out because I'm going to go back, you know, kind of between Christmas and New Year to see my mom who still lives there. And I've certainly had a lot of emails and texts and phone calls from people. I was going back to Bishop Auckland on a very regular basis up until COVID hit. In fact, I mean, the last time I was there was just before I ended up getting embroiled in the whole impeachment process. I was there for a chunk of time in 2019 after I'd left the NSC, visiting my mother and all my relatives, you know, driving around. And at the time, thinking about writing something. I wasn't quite sure what. And I started to kind of, you know, lay some of the groundwork there about thinking about deindustrialization and populism, actually, is what I was thinking about working on. I hadn't quite framed it in the way that, you know, I had in the book yet. And yeah, I mean, a lot of people have been quite surprised. Let's just say they were completely shocked when I appeared in front of millions of people, you know, global audience at the impeachment. I mean, that was, I think, you know, most of my relatives just couldn't quite fathom it. I couldn't quite fathom it, actually, in retrospect, you know, after I kind of came out to everywhere and saw my back that I'd been on the page of every major international newspaper. I just never anticipated that.
And it may have been quite different if somebody hadn't lost a file behind a radiator.
It would have been. I mean, there are many ways along this that I just think about happenstance, right? I think that's the case in most people's careers. It's just, you know, how chance encounters, strange quirks of fate that take you on a path. But certainly, you know, kind of going back to where we started, I'd always been interested in Russia. And, you know, from that heady environment, that rather unnerving environment of the Euro missile crisis, you know, beginning in the late 1970s, you know, when I'm basically coming to my political consciousness, and always then, you know, having my whole world outlook shaped about what can we do, you know, to kind of, as my Uncle Charlie said, figure out why they want to blow us up. But now it's still about why they just still want to think of us as the adversary. And, you know, this is not about, you know, I often when I try to talk about it in this more nuanced way, because I've spent a lot of time in Russia, I know a lot of Russians, you know, that you've got to practice strategic empathy here and understand where they're coming from. And I, you know, understand where they come from a totally different basis, as I explain in the book. When I got to the Soviet Union, it was the land of workers. I was from the working class. I immediately felt an affinity with everyone I met, not on a political basis, but just as like, yeah, their dads were coal miners and steel workers, and they were the first in their family, you know, often at my institute to go to college. They were also trying to train to be interpreters. They had the same, you know, outlook as I did. They didn't care about the politics. They weren't members of the Communist Party. You know, the whole world was changing, and they were just sort of thinking about what were they going to do with themselves. And many of those people I met then are in the Russian government in senior positions. Or they did become interpreters, and they were interpreters at the United Nations. And there's a couple of them, you know, that I know here in Washington, D.C. One, his family basically, you know, left the Soviet Union. They fled, you know, kind of on a trip and didn't come back. And another one, a green card in a lottery. You know, so it's like, you know, I have a long and very diffuse and diverse experience in Russia, and I'm still trying to figure it out. If we get stuck in a framework, we might not see an opportunity to put this on a different track.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Fiona Hill, Robert Bosch Senior Fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. She is the author of the new book, There Is Nothing For You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century. Fiona, it's always a delight to chat.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The books and articles mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for the President's Inbox on CFR.org. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.